This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Bloody Chamber, written by Angela Carter, performed by Amelia Fox and Richard Armitage. The Bloody Chamber. I remember how, that night, I lay awake in the Wagonlea in a tender, delicious ecstasy of excitement, my burning cheek pressed against the impeccable linen of the pillow, and the pounding of my heart mimicking that of the great pistons ceaselessly thrusting the train that bore me through the night away from Paris, away from girlhood, away from the white, enclosed quietude of my mother's apartment into the unguessable country of marriage. And I remember I tenderly imagined how, at this very moment, my mother would be moving slowly about the narrow bedroom I had left behind forever, folding up and putting away all my little relics, the tumbled garments I would not need any more, the scores for which there had been no room in my trunks, the concert programs I'd abandoned. She would linger over this torn ribbon and that faded photograph with all the half-joyous, half-sorrowful emotions of a woman on her daughter's wedding day. And in the midst of my bridal triumph, I felt a pang of loss, as if, when he put the gold band on my finger, I had, in some way, ceased to be her child in becoming his wife. "Are you sure?" she'd said when they delivered the gigantic box that held the wedding dress he'd bought me, wrapped up in tissue paper and red ribbon like a Christmas gift of crystallized fruit. "Are you sure you love him?" There was a dress for her too, black silk, with the dull prismatic sheen of oil on water, finer than anything she'd worn since that adventurous girlhood in Indochina, daughter of a rich tea planter. My eagle-featured, indomitable mother. What other student at the conservatoire could boast that her mother had outfaced a junkful of Chinese pirates, nursed a village through a visitation of the plague, shot a man-eating tiger with her own hand, and all before she was as old as I? "Are you sure you love him?" "I'm sure I want to marry him," I said, and would say no more. She sighed, as if it was with reluctance that she might at last banish the spectre of poverty from its habitual place at our meagre table. For my mother herself had gladly, scandalously, defiantly beggared herself for love. And, one fine day, her gallant soldier never returned from the wars, leaving his wife and child a legacy of tears that never quite dried, a cigar box full of medals, and the antique service revolver that my mother, grown magnificently eccentric in hardship, kept always in her reticule, in case, how I teased her, she was surprised by footpads on her way home from the grocer's shop. Now and then, a starburst of lights spattered the drawn blinds, as if the railway company had lit up all the stations through which we passed in celebration of the bride. My satin nightdress had just been shaken from its wrappings. It had slipped over my young girl's pointed breasts and shoulders, supple as a garment of heavy water, and now teasingly caressed me, egregious, insinuating, nudging between my thighs as I shifted restlessly in my narrow berth. His kiss. His kiss with tongue and teeth in it and a rasp of beard had hinted to me, though with the same exquisite tact as this nightdress he'd given me, of the wedding night, which would be voluptuously deferred until we lay in his great ancestral bed in the sea-girt, pinnacle domain that lay, still, beyond the grasp of my imagination. That magic place, the fairy castle whose walls were made of foam, that legendary habitation in which he had been born, to which, one day, I might bear an heir. Our destination, my destiny. Above the syncopated roar of the train, I could hear his even, steady breathing. Only the communicating door kept me from my husband, and it stood open. If I rose up on my elbow, I could see the dark, leonine shape of his head, and my nostrils caught a whiff of the opulent male scent of leather and spices that always accompanied him, and sometimes, during his courtship, had been the only hint he gave me that he had come into my mother's sitting room. For, though he was a big man, he moved as softly as if all his shoes had soles of velvet, as if his footfall turned the carpet into snow. He had loved to surprise me in my abstracted solitude at the piano. He would tell them not to announce him, then soundlessly open the door and softly creep up behind me with his bouquet of hothouse flowers or his box of marron glacé, lay his offering upon the keys and clasp his hands over my eyes as I was lost in a Debussy prelude. But that perfume of spiced leather always betrayed him. After my first shock, I was forced always to mimic surprise so that he would not be disappointed. He was older than I. He was much older than I. There were streaks of pure silver in his dark mane. But his strange, heavy, almost waxen face was not lined by experience. Rather, experience seemed to have washed it perfectly smooth, like a stone on a beach whose fissures have been eroded by successive tides. And sometimes that face, in stillness when he listened to me playing, with the heavy eyelids folded over eyes that always disturbed me by their absolute absence of light, seemed to me like a mask, as if his real face, the face that truly reflected all the life he had led in the world before he met me, before even I was born, as though that face lay underneath this mask, or else elsewhere. As though he had laid by the face in which he had lived for so long, in order to offer my youth a face unsigned by the years. And elsewhere, I might see him plain. Elsewhere. But where? In, perhaps, that castle to which the train now took us, that marvellous castle in which he had been born. Even when he asked me to marry him, and I said yes, still he did not lose that heavy, fleshy composure of his. I know it must seem a curious analogy, a man with a flower, but sometimes he seemed to me like a lily. Yes, a lily, possessed of that strange, ominous calm of a sentient vegetable, like one of those cobra-headed, funereal lilies whose white sheaths are curled out of a flesh as thick and tensely yielding to the touch as vellum. When I said that I would marry him, not one muscle in his face stirred, but he let out a long, extinguished sigh. I thought, oh, how he must want me. And it was as though the imponderable weight of his desire was a force I might not withstand, not by virtue of its violence, but because of its very gravity. He had the ring ready in a leather box lined with crimson velvet. A fire opal the size of a pigeon's egg set in a complicated circle of dark, antique gold. My old nurse, who still lived with my mother and me, squinted at the ring askance.
"Opals are bad luck," she said.
But this opal had been his own mother's ring, and his grandmother's, and her mother's before that, given to an ancestor by Catherine de' Medici. Every bride that came to the castle wore it, time out of mind.
"And did he give it to his other wives and have it back from them?"
asked the old woman rudely. Yet she was a snob. She hid her incredulous joy at my marital coup, her little marquise, behind a facade of fault-finding. But here she touched me. I shrugged and turned my back pettishly on her. I did not want to remember how he had loved other women before me, but the knowledge often teased me in the threadbare self-confidence of the small hours. I was 17 and knew nothing of the world. My Marquis had been married before, more than once, and I remained a little bemused that, after those others, he should now have chosen me. Indeed, was he not still in mourning for his last wife? Went my old nurse, and even my mother had been reluctant to see her girl whisked off by a man so recently bereaved. A Romanian countess, a lady of high fashion, dead just 3 short months before I met him, a boating accident at his home in Brittany. They never found her body, but I rummaged through the back copies of the society magazines my old nanny kept in a trunk under her bed and tracked down her photograph. The sharp muzzle of a pretty, witty, naughty monkey. Such potent and bizarre charm, of a dark, bright, wild yet worldly thing whose natural habitat must have been some luxurious interior decorator's jungle filled with potted palms and tame squawking parakeets. Before that? Her face is common property. Everyone painted her. But the Redon engraving I liked best, the evening star walking on the rim of night. To see her skeletal, enigmatic grace, you would never think she had been a barmaid in a cafe in Montmartre, until Puvis de Chavannes saw her and had her expose her flat breasts and elongated thighs to his brush. And yet it was the absinthe doomed her, or so they said. The first of all his ladies? That sumptuous diva. I had heard her sing Isolde. Precociously musical child that I was, taken to the opera for a birthday treat. My first opera. I had heard her sing Isolde. With what white-hot passion had she burned from the stage, so that you could tell she would die young? We sat high up, halfway to heaven in the gods, yet she half-blinded me. And my father, still alive, oh, so long ago, took hold of my sticky little hand to comfort me in the last act, yet all I heard was the glory of her voice. Married 3 times within my own brief lifetime to 3 different graces, now, as if to demonstrate the eclecticism of his taste, he had invited me to join this gallery of beautiful women. I, the poor widow's child with my mouse-coloured hair that still bore the kinks of the plaits from which it had so recently been freed, my bony hips, my nervous pianist's fingers. He was rich as Croesus. The night before our wedding, a simple affair at the Mairie, because his countess was so recently gone, he took my mother and me, curious coincidence, to see Tristan. And, do you know, my heart swelled and ached so during the Liebestod that I thought I must truly love him. Yes, I did. On his arm, all eyes were upon me. The whispering crowd in the foyer parted like the Red Sea to let us through. My skin crisped at his touch. How my circumstances had changed since the first time I heard those voluptuous chords that carry such a charge of deathly passion in them. Now we sat in a loge, in red velvet armchairs, and a braided, bewigged flunky brought us a silver bucket of iced champagne in the interval. The froth spilled over the rim of my glass and drenched my hands. I thought, my cup runneth over. And I had on a Poiret dress. He had prevailed upon my reluctant mother to let him buy my trousseau. What would I have gone to him in otherwise? 2x darned underwear, faded gingham, serge skirts, hand-me-downs. So, for the opera, I wore a sinuous shift of white muslin tied with a silk string under the breasts, and everyone stared at me. And at his wedding gift. His wedding gift, clasped round my throat. A choker of rubies, 2 inches wide, like an extraordinarily precious slit throat. After the terror, in the early days of the Directory, the aristos who'd escaped the guillotine had an ironic fad of tying a red ribbon round their necks at just the point where the blade would have sliced it through, a red ribbon like the memory of a wound. And his grandmother, taken with the notion, had her ribbon made up in rubies. Such a gesture of luxurious defiance. That night at the opera comes back to me even now. The white dress, the frail child within it, and the flashing crimson jewels round her throat, bright as arterial blood. I saw him watching me in the gilded mirrors with the assessing eye of a connoisseur inspecting horseflesh, or even of a housewife in the market inspecting cuts on the slab. I'd never seen, or else had never acknowledged, that regard of his before, the sheer carnal avarice of it, and it was strangely magnified by the monocle lodged in his left eye. When I saw him look at me with lust, I dropped my eyes. But in glancing away from him, I caught sight of myself in the mirror. And I saw myself, suddenly, as he saw me. My pale face, the way the muscles in my neck stuck out like thin wire. I saw how that cruel necklace became me, and, for the first time in my innocent and confined life, I sensed in myself a potentiality for corruption that took my breath away. The next day, we were married. The train slowed, shuddered to a halt. Lights, clank of metal, a voice declaring the name of an unknown, never-to-be-visited station. Silence of the night, the rhythm of his breathing. That I should sleep with now for the rest of my life. And I could not sleep. I stealthily sat up, raised the blind a little, and huddled against the cold window that misted over with the warmth of my breathing, gazing out at the dark platform towards those rectangles of domestic lamplight that promised warmth, company, a supper of sausages hissing in a pan on the stove for the station master, his children tucked up in bed asleep in the brick house with the painted shutters. All the paraphernalia of the everyday world from which I, with my stunning marriage, had exiled myself. Into marriage, into exile. I sensed it. I knew it. That henceforth, I would always be lonely. Yet that was part of the already familiar weight of the fire opal that glimmered like a gypsy's magic ball so that I could not take my eyes off it when I played the piano. This ring, the bloody bandage of rubies, the wardrobe of clothes from Poiret and Worth, his scent of Russian leather, all had conspired to seduce me so utterly that I could not say I felt one single twinge of regret for the world of Tartine and Maman that now receded from me as if drawn away on a string like a child's toy as the train began to throb again as if in delighted anticipation of the distance it would take me. The first grey streamers of the dawn now flew in the sky and an eldritch half-light seeped into the railway carriage. I heard no change in his breathing, but my heightened, excited senses told me he was awake and gazing at me. A huge man, an enormous man, and his eyes, dark and motionless, as those eyes the ancient Egyptians painted upon their sarcophagi, fixed upon me. I felt a certain tension in the pit of my stomach to be so watched in such silence. A match struck. He was igniting a Romeo e Giulietta, fat as a baby's arm.
"Soon," he said in his resonant voice that was like the tolling of a bell, and I felt all at once a sharp premonition of dread that lasted only as long as the match flared, and I could see his white, broad face as if it were hovering, disembodied, above the sheets, illuminated from below like a grotesque carnival head.
Then the flame died, the cigar glowed and filled the compartment with a remembered fragrance that made me think of my father, how he would hug me in a warm fug of Havana when I was a little girl, before he kissed me and left me and died. As soon as my husband handed me down from the high step of the train, I smelled the amniotic salinity of the ocean. It was November. The trees, stunted by the Atlantic gales, were bare, and the lonely halt was deserted, but for his leather-gated chauffeur waiting meekly beside the sleek black motor car. It was cold. I drew my furs about me, a wrap of white and black, broad stripes of ermine and sable, with a collar from which my head rose like the calyx of a wild flower. I swear to you, I had never been vain until I met him. The bell clanged. The straining train leapt its leash and left us at that lonely wayside halt where only he and I had descended. Oh, the wonder of it! How all that might of iron and steam had paused only to suit his convenience. The richest man in France.
Madame?
The chauffeur eyed me. Was he comparing me, invidiously, to the countess, the artist's model, the opera singer? I hid behind my furs as if they were a system of soft shields. My husband liked me to wear my opal over my kid glove, a showy, theatrical trick. But the moment the ironic chauffeur glimpsed its simmering flash, he smiled, as though it was proof positive I was his master's wife. And we drove towards the widening dawn, that now streaked half the sky with a wintry bouquet of pink of roses, orange of tiger lilies, as if my husband had ordered me a sky from a florist. The day broke around me like a cool dream. Sea. Sand. A sky that melts into the sea. A landscape of misty pastels with a look about it of being continuously on the point of melting. A landscape with all the deliquescent harmonies of Debussy, of the etude I played for him, the reverie I'd been playing that afternoon in the salon of the princess where I'd first met him, among the teacups and the little cakes, I, the orphan, hired out of charity to give them their digestif of music. And, oh, his castle, the fairy solitude of the place, with its turrets of misty blue, its courtyard, its spiked gate, his castle that lay on the very bosom of the sea, with seabirds mewing about its attics, the casements opening onto the green and purple, evanescent departures of the ocean, cut off by the tide from land for half a day. That castle, at home neither on the land nor on the water, a mysterious, amphibious place, contravening the materiality of both earth and the waves, with the melancholy of a mermaiden who perches on her rock and waits, endlessly, for a lover who had drowned far away, long ago. That lovely, sad, sea siren of a place. The tide was low. At this hour, so early in the morning, the causeway rose up out of the sea. As the car turned onto the wet cobbles between the slow margins of water, he reached out for my hand that had his sultry, witchy ring on it, pressed my fingers, kissed my palm with extraordinary tenderness. His face was as still as ever I'd seen it, still as a pond iced thickly over. Yet his lips, that always looked so strangely red and naked between the black fringes of his beard, now curved a little. He smiled. He welcomed his bride home. No room, no corridor that did not rustle with the sound of the sea, and all the ceilings, the walls on which his ancestors, in the stern regalia of rank, lined up with their dark eyes and white faces, were stippled with refracted light from the waves which were always in motion. That luminous, murmurous castle, of which I was the chatelaine. I, the little music student whose mother had sold all her jewellery, even her wedding ring, to pay the fees at the conservatoire. First of all, there was the small ordeal of my initial interview with the housekeeper who kept this extraordinary machine, this anchored, castellated ocean liner, in smooth running order, no matter who stood on the bridge. How tenuous, I thought, might be my authority here. She had a bland, pale, impassive, dislikable face beneath the impeccably starched white linen headdress of the region. Her greeting, correct but lifeless, chilled me. Daydreaming, I dared presume too much on my status, briefly wondered how I might install my old nurse, so much loved, however cozily incompetent, in her place. Ill-considered schemings. He told me this one had been his foster mother, was bound to his family in the utmost feudal complicity. As much part of the house as I am, my dear. Now her thin lips offered me a proud little smile. She would be my ally as long as I was his. And with that, I must be content. But here, it would be easy to be content. In the turret suite he had given me for my very own, I could gaze out over the tumultuous Atlantic and imagine myself the queen of the sea. There was a Bechstein for me in the music room, and, on the wall, another wedding present, an early Flemish primitive of St. Cecilia at her celestial organ. In the prim charm of this saint, with her plump, sallow cheeks and crinkled brown hair, I saw myself as I could have wished to be. I warmed to a loving sensitivity I had not hitherto suspected in him. Then he led me up a delicate spiral staircase to my bedroom. Before she discreetly vanished, the housekeeper set him chuckling with some, I dare say, lewd blessing for newlyweds in her native Breton. That I did not understand. That he, smiling, refused to interpret. And there lay the grand, hereditary matrimonial bed, itself the size, almost, of my little room at home, with the gargoyles carved on its surfaces of ebony, vermilion lacquer, gold leaf, and its white gauze curtains billowing in the sea breeze. Our bed. And surrounded by so many mirrors. Mirrors on all the walls, in stately frames of contorted gold that reflected more white lilies than I'd ever seen in my life before. He'd filled the room with them to greet the bride, the young bride. The young bride, who had become that multitude of girls I saw in the mirrors, identical in their chic navy blue tailor-maids for travelling, madame, or walking. A maid had dealt with the furs. Henceforth, a maid would deal with everything. "See," he said, gesturing towards those elegant girls.
I have acquired a whole harem for myself.
I found that I was trembling. My breath came thickly. I could not meet his eye and turned my head away, out of pride, out of shyness, and watched a dozen husbands approach me in a dozen mirrors, and slowly, methodically, teasingly, unfasten the buttons of my jacket and slip it from my shoulders. Enough! No more! Off comes the skirt, and next the blouse of apricot linen that cost more than the dress I had for First Communion. The play of the waves outside in the cold sun glittered on his monocle. His movement seemed to me deliberately coarse, vulgar. The blood rushed to my face again and stayed there. And yet, you see, I guessed it might be so, that we should have a formal disrobing of the bride, a ritual from the brothel. Sheltered as my life had been, how could I have failed, even in the world of prim bohemia in which I lived, to have heard hints of his world? He stripped me, gourmand that he was, as if he was stripping the leaves off an artichoke. But do not imagine much finesse about it. This artichoke was no particular treat for the diner, nor was he yet in any greedy haste. He approached his familiar treat with a weary appetite. And, when nothing but my scarlet, palpitating core remained, I saw in the mirror the living image of an etching by Robs from the collection he had shown me when our engagement permitted us to be alone together. The child with her stick-like limbs, naked but for her button boots, her gloves, shielding her face with her hand, as though her face were the last repository of her modesty. And the old, monocled lecher who examined her, limb by limb. He in his London tailoring, she bare as a lamb chop. Most pornographic of all confrontations. And so my purchaser unwrapped his bargain. And, as at the opera, when I had first seen my flesh in his eyes, I was aghast to feel myself stirring. At once he closed my legs like a book, and I saw again the rare movement of his lips that meant he smiled. Not yet. Later. Anticipation is the greater part of pleasure, my little love. And I began to shudder, like a racehorse before a race, yet also with a kind of fear, for I felt both a strange, impersonal arousal at the thought of love, and at the same time a repugnance I could not stifle for his white, heavy flesh that had too much in common with the armfuls of arum lilies that filled my bedroom in great glass jars, those undertaker's lilies with the heavy pollen that powders your fingers as if you would dip them in turmeric. The lilies I always associate with him, that are white and stain you. This scene from a voluptuary's life was now abruptly terminated. It turns out he has business to attend to, his estates, his companies, even on your honeymoon. Even then, said the red lips that kissed me before he left me alone with my bewildered senses, a wet silken brush from his beard, a hint of the pointed tip of the tongue. Disgruntled, I wrapped a negligee of antique lace around me to sip the little breakfast of hot chocolate the maid brought me. After that, since it was second nature to me, there was nowhere to go but the music room, and soon I settled down at my piano. Yet only a series of subtle discords flowed from beneath my fingers. Out of tune, only a little out of tune, but I'd been blessed with perfect pitch and could not bear to play any more. Sea breezes are bad for pianos. We shall need a resident piano tuner on the premises if I'm to continue with my studies. I flung down the lid in a little fury of disappointment. What should I do now? How shall I pass the long, sea-lit hours until my husband beds me? I shivered to think of that. His library seemed the source of his habitual odour of Russian leather. Row upon row of calf-bound volumes, brown and olive, with gilt lettering on their spines, the octavo in brilliant scarlet morocco. A deep-buttoned leather sofa to recline on. A lectern, carved like a spread eagle, that held open upon it an edition of Eastman's Là-bas, from some over-exquisite private press. It had been bound like a missal, in brass, with gems of coloured glass. The rugs on the floor, deep, pulsing blues of heaven and red of the heart's dearest blood, came from Isfahan and Bokhara. The dark panelling gleamed. There was the lulling music of the sea and a fire of apple logs. The flames flickered along the spines inside a glass-fronted case that held books still crisp and new. Eliphas Levi. The name meant nothing to me. I squinted at a title or two. The Initiation, The Key of Mysteries, The Secret of Pandora's Box. And yawned. Nothing here to detain a 17-year-old girl waiting for her first embrace. I should have liked, best of all, a novel in yellow paper. I wanted to curl up on the rug before the blazing fire, lose myself in a cheap novel, munch sticky liqueur chocolates. If I rang for them, a maid would bring me chocolates. Nevertheless, I opened the doors of that bookcase idly to browse. And I think I knew by some tingling of the fingertips, even before I opened that slim volume with no title at all on the spine, what I should find inside it. When he showed me the ROPS, newly bought, dearly prized, had he not hinted that he was a connoisseur of such things? Yet I had not bargained for this. The girl, with tears hanging on her cheeks like stuck pearls, her cunt, a split fig below the great globes of her buttocks, on which the knotted tails of the cat were about to descend, while a man in a black mask fingered with his free hand his prick that curved upwards like the scimitar he held. The picture had a caption, "Reproof of Curiosity." My mother, with all the precision of her eccentricity, had told me what it was that lovers did. I was innocent, but not naive. The Adventures of Eulalie at the Harem of the Grand Turk had been printed, according to the flyleaf, in Amsterdam in 1748, a rare collector's piece. Had some ancestor brought it back himself from that northern city? Or had my husband bought it for himself, from one of those dusty little bookshops on the left bank, where an old man peers at you through spectacles an inch thick, daring you to inspect his wares? I turned the pages in the anticipation of fear. The print was rusty. Here was another steel engraving. Immolation of the Wives of the Sultan. I knew enough for what I saw in that book to make me gasp. There was a pungent intensification of the odour of leather that suffused his library. His shadow fell across the massacre.
"My little nun has found the prayer books, has she?" he demanded, with a curious mixture of mockery and relish. Then, seeing my painful, furious bewilderment, he laughed at me aloud, snatched the book from my hands, and put it down on the sofa. "Have the nasty pictures scared, baby? Baby mustn't play with grown-ups' toys until she's learned how to handle them, must she?
Then he kissed me, and with, this time, no reticence. He kissed me and laid his hand imperatively upon my breast, beneath the sheath of ancient lace. I stumbled on the winding stair that led to the bedroom, to the carved, gilded bed on which he had been conceived. I stammered foolishly, "We have not taken luncheon yet, and besides, it is broad daylight."
"All the better to see you."
He made me put on my choker, the family heirloom of one woman who had escaped the blade. With trembling fingers, I fastened the thing about my neck. It was cold as ice and chilled me. He twined my hair into a rope and lifted it off my shoulders so that he could the better kiss the downy furrows below my ears that made me shudder. And he kissed those blazing rubies, too. He kissed them before he kissed my mouth. "Rapt," he intoned,
"of her apparel she retains only her sonorous jewelry."
A dozen husbands impaled a dozen brides, while the mewing gulls swung on invisible trapezes in the empty air outside. I was brought to my senses by the insistent shrilling of the telephone. He lay beside me, felled like an oak, breathing stertorously, as if he had been fighting with me. In the course of that one-sided struggle, I had seen his deathly composure shatter like a porcelain vase flung against a wall. I had heard him shriek and blaspheme at the orgasm. I had bled, and perhaps I had seen his face without its mask. And perhaps I had not. Yet I had been infinitely dishevelled by the loss of my virginity. I gathered myself together, reached into the cloisonné cupboard beside the bed that concealed the telephone, and addressed the mouthpiece. His agent in New York. Urgent. I shook him awake and rolled over on my side, cradling my spent body in my arms. His voice buzzed like a hive of distant bees. My husband. My husband, who, with so much love, filled my bedroom with lilies until it looked like an embalming parlour. Those somnolent lilies that wave their heavy heads, distributing their lush, insolent incense, reminiscent of pampered flesh. When he'd finished with the agent, he turned to me and stroked the ruby necklace that bit into my neck, but with such tenderness now that I ceased flinching and he caressed my breasts.
"My dear one, my little love, my child, did it hurt her?"
He's so sorry for it. Such impetuousness. He could not help himself. You see, he loves her so. And this lover's recitative of his brought my tears in a flood. I clung to him as though only the one who had inflicted the pain could comfort me for suffering it. For a while, he murmured to me in a voice I'd never heard before, a voice like the soft consolations of the sea. But then he unwound the tendrils of my hair from the buttons of his smoking jacket, kissed my cheek briskly, and told me the agent from New York had called with such urgent business that he must leave as soon as the tide was low enough. Leave the castle? Leave France? And would be away for at least 6 weeks. But it is our honeymoon. A deal, an enterprise of hazard and chance involving several millions, lay in the balance, he said. He drew away from me into that waxwork stillness of his. I was only a little girl. I did not understand. And, he said unspoken to my wounded vanity, I have had too many honeymoons to find them in the least pressing commitments.
I know quite well that this child I've bought with a handful of coloured stones and the pelts of dead beasts won't run away. But after he'd called his Paris agent to book a passage for the States next day, just one tiny call, my little one, we should have time for dinner together. And I had to be content with that. A Mexican dish of pheasant with hazelnuts and chocolate. Salad. White, voluptuous cheese. A sorbet of muscat grapes and Asti spumante. A celebration of Krug exploded festively, and then acrid black coffee in precious little cups so fine it shadowed the birds with which they were painted. I had Cointreau. He had cognac in the library, with the purple velvet curtains drawn against the night, where he took me to perch on his knee in a leather armchair beside the flickering log fire. He had made me change into that chaste little poiré shift of white muslin. He seemed especially fond of it. "My breasts showed through the flimsy stuff," he said, "like little soft white doves that sleep, each one with a pink eye open." But he would not let me take off my ruby choker, although it was grown very uncomfortable, nor fasten up my descending hair, the sign of a virginity so recently ruptured that still remained a wounded presence between us. He twined his fingers in my hair until I winced. I said, I remember, very little. "The maid will have changed our sheets already," he said. "We do not hang the bloody sheets out of the window to prove to the whole of Brittany you are a virgin, not in these civilized times. But I should tell you, it would have been the first time in all my married lives I could have shown my interested tenants such a flag." Then I realized, with a shock of surprise, how it must have been my innocence that captivated him. "The silent music," he said, "of my unknowingness, like La Terrasse des Audiences au clair de lune, played upon a piano with keys of ether." You must remember how ill at ease I was in that luxurious place, how our knees had been my constant companion during the whole length of my courtship by this grave satyr, who now gently martyrized my hair. To know that my naivety gave him some pleasure made me take heart. Courage! I shall act the fine lady to the manner born one day, if only by virtue of default. Then, slowly yet teasingly, as if he were giving a child a great mysterious treat, he took out a bunch of keys from some interior hidey-hole in his jacket. Key after key. "A key," he said, "for every lock in the house." Keys of all kinds, huge, ancient things of black iron. Others, slender, delicate, almost baroque. Wafer-thin Yale keys for safes and boxes. And, during his absence, it was I who must take care of them all. I eyed the heavy bunch with circumspection. Until that moment, I had not given a single thought to the practical aspects of marriage, with a great house, great wealth, a great man, whose key ring was as crowded as that of a prison warder. Here were the clumsy and archaic keys for the dungeons. For dungeons we had in plenty, although they had been converted to cellars for his wines. The dusty bottles inhabited in racks all those deep holes of pain in the rock on which the castle was built. "These are the keys to the kitchens. This is the key to the picture gallery, a treasure house filled by 5 centuries of avid collectors. Ah!" He foresaw I would spend hours there. He had amply indulged his taste for the symbolists, he told me, with a glint of greed. There was Morrow's great portrait of his first wife, the famous sacrificial victim with the imprint of the lace-like chains on her pellucid skin. Did I know the story of the painting of that picture? How, when she took off her clothes for him for the first time, she, fresh from her bar in Montmartre, she had robed herself involuntarily in a blush that reddened her breasts, her shoulders, her arms, her whole body. He had thought of that story, of that dear girl, when first he had undressed me. Ensor, the great Ensor, his monolithic canvas, the foolish virgins. Two or three late Gauguins, his special favourite, the one of the tranced brown girl in the deserted house, which was called Out of the Night We Come, Into the Night We Go. And, besides the additions he had made himself, his marvellous inheritance of Watteaus, Poussins, and a pair of very special Fragonards commissioned for a licentious ancestor, who, it was said, had posed for the master's brush himself with his own two daughters. He broke off his catalogue of treasures abruptly. "Your thin white face, chérie," he said, as if he saw it for the first time. "Your thin white face, with its promise of debauchery only a connoisseur could detect." A log fell in the fire, instigating a shower of sparks. The opal on my finger spurted green flame. I felt as giddy as if I were on the edge of a precipice. I was afraid, not so much of him, of his monstrous presence, heavy as if he had been gifted at birth with more specific gravity than the rest of us, the presence that, even when I thought myself most in love with him, always subtly oppressed me. No, I was not afraid of him, but of myself. I seemed reborn in his unreflective eyes, reborn in unfamiliar shapes. I hardly recognized myself from his descriptions of me, and yet... might there not be a grain of beastly truth in them? And, in the red firelight, I blushed again, unnoticed, to think he might have chosen me because, in my innocence, he sensed a rare talent for corruption. "Here is the key to the china cabinet. Don't laugh, my darling. There's a king's ransom in Sèvres in that closet, and a queen's ransom in Limoges, and a key to the locked barred room where 5 generations of plate were kept." Keys, keys, keys. He would trust me with the keys to his office, although I was only a baby, and the keys to his safes, where he kept the jewels I should wear he promised me when we returned to Paris. Such jewels! Why, I would be able to change my earrings and necklaces 3 times a day, just as the Empress Josephine used to change her underwear. "He doubted," he said, with that hollow knocking sound that served him for a chuckle. "I would be quite so interested in his share certificates, although they, of course, were worth infinitely more." Outside our firelit privacy, I could hear the sound of the tide drawing back from the pebbles of the foreshore. It was nearly time for him to leave me. One single key remained unaccounted for on the ring, and he hesitated over it. For a moment, I thought he was going to unfasten it from its brothers, slip it back into his pocket, and take it away with him. "What is that key?" I demanded, for his chafing had made me bold. "The key to your heart. Give it me." He dangled the key tantalizingly above my head, out of reach of my straining fingers. Those bare red lips of his cracked sidelong in a smile. "Ah, no," he said, "not the key to my heart. Rather, the key to my enfer." He left it on the ring, fastened the ring together, shook it musically like a carillon. then threw the keys in a jingling heap in my lap. I could feel the cold metal chilling my thighs through my thin muslin frock. He bent over me to drop a beard-masked kiss on my forehead. "Every man must have one secret, even if only one, from his wife," he said. "Promise me this, my way-faced piano player. Promise me you'll use all the keys on the ring except that last little one I showed you. Play with anything you find, jewels, silver plate, make toy boats of my share certificates, if it pleases you, and send them sailing off to America after me. All is yours. Everywhere is open to you. Except the lock that this single key fits. Yet all it is the key to a little room at the foot of the West Tower, behind the still room, at the end of a dark little corridor full of horrid cobwebs that would get into your hair and frighten you if you ventured there. Oh, and you'd find it such a dull little room. But you must promise me, if you love me, to leave it well alone. It is only a private study, a hideaway, a den, as the English say, where I can go sometimes on those infrequent yet inevitable occasions when the yoke of marriage seems to weigh too heavily on my shoulders. There I can go, you understand, to savour the rare pleasure of imagining myself wifeless. There was a little thin starlight in the courtyard as, wrapped in my furs, I saw him to his car. His last words were that he had telephoned the mainland and taken a piano tuner onto the staff. This man would arrive to take up his duties the next day. He pressed me to his vicuna breast once and then drove away. I had drowsed away that afternoon, and now I could not sleep. I lay tossing and turning in his ancestral bed until another daybreak discoloured the dozen mirrors that were iridescent with the reflections of the sea. The perfume of the lilies weighed on my senses when I thought that henceforth I would always share these sheets with a man whose skin, as theirs did, contained that toad-like, clammy hint of moisture. I felt a vague desolation that within me, now my female wound had healed, there had awoken a certain queasy craving, like the cravings of pregnant women for the taste of coal or chalk or tainted food, for the renewal of his caresses. Had he not hinted to me, in his flesh, as in his speech and looks, of the thousand, thousand baroque intersections of flesh upon flesh? I lay in our wide bed, accompanied by a sleepless companion, my dark, newborn curiosity. I lay in bed alone, and I longed for him, and he disgusted me. Were there jewels enough in all his safes to recompense me for this predicament? Did all that castle hold enough riches to recompense me for the company of the libertine with whom I must share it? And what precisely was the nature of my desirous dread for this mysterious being who, to show his mastery over me, had abandoned me on my wedding night? Then I sat straight up in bed, under the sardonic masks of the gargoyles carved above me, riven by a wild surmise. Might he have left me, not for Wall Street, but for an importunate mistress tucked away, God knows where, who knew how to pleasure him far better than a girl whose fingers had been exercised hitherto only by the practice of scales and arpeggios. And, slowly, soothed, I sank back onto the heaping pillows. I acknowledged that the jealous scare I'd just given myself was not unmixed with a little tincture of relief. At last, I drifted into slumber, as daylight filled the room and chased bad dreams away. But the last thing I remembered, before I slept, was the tall jar of lilies beside the bed. how the thick glass distorted their fat stems so they looked like arms, dismembered arms, drifting, drowned in greenish water. Coffee and croissant to console this bridal solitary waking. Delicious.